Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Book Network. My name is Roy Barzaz. I'm a host of the NBN channel. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Galit Atlas on her edited work, When Minds Meet, the work of Lewis Aaron, published by Routledge in 2021. Dr. Atlas is on the faculty of the NYU postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. She is also the author of The Enigma of Desire, Sex, Longing, and Belonging in Psychoanalysis, and Dramatic Dialogues, which she co-authored with Lewis Aaron in 2017. She's a faculty member of the four-year adult and national training program at the National Institute for the Psychotherapies. She serves on the editorial board of Psychoanalytic Perspectives and is an analyst and clinical supervisor in private practice in New York City. But it is particularly relevant for you as listeners to know that she was Lou's life partner, and together it is she and Lou, prior to his untimely death, that curated the papers that appear in this book. And I personally feel very honored to be interviewing Galit, as Lou was very instrumental in my own work in the text Core Competencies, where I wrote in my acknowledgement to him that Lou Aaron, without whose vision and advocacy this text would not have come to be. He is a man of extraordinary vision and contribution, and I'm humbled that my idea caught his eye and that he saw the value in my efforts for my book. And the thing about Lou is that I knew that I was just one of many that he had advocated for to have our work published and seen. And so I'm very deeply grateful to him. And when he was here in Seattle and I introduced him for our weekend seminar with him, I do remember saying, some of you may or may not know have read something of Lou, but I can assure you, if you've read anything in psychoanalysis, you have read Lou Aaron, because he is prolific and if he hasn't written it, he's been quoted. And so it is with such a privilege that I get to interview Galit, who is so deeply connected to Lou. And I was telling her before the interview that when he was here in Seattle, their relationship was in its early stages, and his deep love for Galit was obvious, and his excitement about her as his partner, as well as her as a analyst and a theorist and a thinker. So I'm just going to say a bit more, and then we'll just dive into the interview. But this book is a marvelous collection of Lou's work, which is representative of the breadth of his mind. In this work, Lou not only offers the reader rich contributions of his theories and his practices, but he is so thorough in grounding his ideas in the historical corpus of psychoanalysis that the reader is schooled not only in Lou's commitment to a two-person relational psychoanalytic idea, but to primary theorists and practices in psychoanalysis from Freud to present day. Also, in my personal experience, as well as in Lou's writing, the beauty of his writing and its polemics is that Lou is not defensive. When reading Lou, I always feel like an invitation to join him in playing with an idea, to let it grow, to co-create, to participate, to wonder. And in reading this text, I again felt the invitation to think and to create and to imagine. Lou appears to find pleasure in difference, even as he holds to his own hermeneutics. He does this in theory as well as in practice. And Galit, you mentioned in the foreword something very similar to this, that Liu believed theory doesn't exist in a vacuum, but must be understood within a historical, political, and sociological context. But in a paragraph later that really caught my eye, you mentioned also that his theories and practice came from the personal. And you cite in particular his interaction with Harold Searles. And I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners a bit more about this.
So first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. This is a very special project for me. As you can imagine, filled with love and with grief. And it's a project that Liu and I started together before he died. And we were thinking about it. And in the last month of his life, I basically told him that I am going to do this for him and publish his work and a book with his articles. The thing is that Liu had more than 112 papers that he published. So you can imagine that to choose 12 chapters, it was very challenging. And I do have to say that Liu and I chose the 12 chapters together, except I made a very, very light changes to the outline. The main thing that I have done, except for editing these papers, is keeping Liu's original idea of how this book should be. So originally, what he wanted is for me to edit this book, even when he was alive, with his articles, and he wanted to write an introduction to each chapter. So kind of, many years later, right, go over each article and say, okay, what do I think about it now? And have a little bit, give the readers not just the articles, but a little bit more for each article. And so he wanted me and he asked me to edit it for him while he would do that. And he started with writing the introduction to the chapter on dreams, which is, let me look, I think it's the first chapter in this book, all right? But he didn't finish writing this introduction even. And I decided to, by the way, that paper on dreams, the chapter on dreams, the first chapter is a paper he presented for the first time in 1987 after he graduated from postdoc. But since he never completed that, I decided to publish it the way it is, so you could see that it's. I did not finish it for him. I just left it as is. And when I started editing this book right after his death, I decided to publish not only this incomplete introduction, but also a new introduction to each of the chapters. So what you get in this book is Liu's 12 articles and a short introduction. I invited a number of colleagues who worked closely with him to write introduction to the rest of the chapters. So going back to your question, I mean, anyone who knew Liu knew that Liu was interested in integrating theory with social context, with the theorist's personal history. And he, every time before he did anything, and, you know, he dived very deeply into every person, every theory he ever taught. And he read anything he could find about, not only about anything that was written about the theory, but also about the actual person that he was teaching. And he wanted to know about their life, and he wanted to know about their relationships and about their childhood and about the social context of their writing and about anything. And I remember him, you know, anyone who knew Liu, and in our family, you know, his kids and my kids, we always laughed that Liu opened his book and he reads all the time with a yellow marker. And he marks the book. I don't know if you've ever seen that. I have many, many of his books with his yellow markers in them, highlights. And really studying. I've never seen somebody who studies the way he did, which really, of course, inspired me and taught me a lot about hard work and about what's, you know, how it looks. So going back to your question about Harold Searles, I think it was in 2012 when he started teaching Harold Searles. It was before Searles died, and he carefully studied his biography and read every chapter, of course, that he had written, and watched some videos that he have of Searles working with patients that he could find. And not so long before Searles died, Lou contacted him, and Searles sent him, emailed him some unpublished videos and papers that Lou then was very proud to have, because nobody had those, and used in his teaching. And when teaching Searles, and in the chapter that, of course, Lou and I wrote in our co-authored book, Dramatic Dialogue, we have a whole chapter on Searles. And there, Lou does this thing, brilliant things that he does, and he discusses Searles' history and how that history made him who he was. I'll give you like a very brief example. Like, he was talking about Harold Searles, the child who was his parents had a clothing store, and he was their model, and how he was a performer from a young age, and later on in life he performed therapy on the stage. And by the way, before, you know, one other thing that I don't think I wrote it in the book, in the introduction, I left it out, but he also met with Harold Searles' daughter, who is a famous actor. Her husband is an actor, and I think her children are actors. And so you see there was some intergenerational acting. And he met with her after Searles' death. And she lives in England. And I think that was some of what was so special about Lou, right? He took everything into, right, and made it very personal and invested a lot in everything he had done.
Well, and I think what is the beauty of that, and even as you talk about it, is sometimes how we ignore the impact of our own personal life, our traditions, our ethnicities, and how really all of our personal life influences our theories and our practices, and which, of course, moves away from sort of one-person psychologies into two-person, where the self of the therapist is so essential within the room. And Lou saw theory through the context of the writer, through the theorist. And yeah, you know, you mentioned Dramatic Dialogues, and in that introduction, you also, well, if you could just say a bit about Dramatic Dialogues that you and Lou wrote together, where you began to rethink, how did you even say it, that therapy is a dramatic dialogue as opposed, and that self as a story, so yeah, just say a little bit more about what the two of you worked with on sort of helping us rethink the therapeutic relationship and dramatic dialogue.
So Dramatic Dialogue was a book that we co-authored. I think we published it in 2017, if I'm not wrong, right? And we worked on it. I do have to say, combining the personal and the professional, is that we worked on it when Lou, we started it before Lou went into his big surgery. He's and he had a very major surgery that we didn't know how he's going to survive, if he's going to survive. And so I think that there is a sense in the book, and if you read it that way, this book was written in the shadow of his illness, when he was actually very sick. After it was published, he was in remission for a few years. But when we wrote it, right, and there's a lot about death and about suffering and co-suffering, but basically the idea of Dramatic Dialogue was thinking about the analytic stage, right, and the way analysts and patients live and relive things together, and how the analyst comes, the analyst life, you know, it's about, a lot of it is about enactment, and about, we talk about generative enactment, which is a term that we developed in that book. And we talk about the perspective function, which is thinking about how we work with the notion of the future. And so if you think about it, even again, think about the personal life, there was a lot about the future, about death, about suffering, but it is a book about therapeutic action and what we call therapeutic traction, and about how we think about contemporary clinical practice, especially around enactment and generative enactment.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say that was a real, this idea of the perspective function and generative enactment, that was such a wonderful awakening for me when I read that, because we speak so much in psychoanalysis of what was and what's relived, but not what's trying to be tried out before one can live it, if you will. And I'm hoping it gains more traction, because I think that these enactments that we have are not only of the past, but practice for when a patient leaves therapy, say, and trying to have a different version of themselves.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like the Dramatic Dialogue was a book that was accepted in a very extraordinary way by people. And I still get a lot of emails about study groups who study that, because in some ways it's a very basic book. You know, it's a short book. It's a book with a lot of clinical material. It's a book with a lot of therapeutic tales, the way we call it. And it's very accessible. It's not a book with a lot of dense theory. Lou, and I think the combination of both of us, Lou is a very clear teacher. Everything, and it's very, very evident in Dramatic Dialogue that his teaching is very clear. I brought a lot of my focus on clinical writing, clinical material, and so there are a lot of stories that we formed, and a lot of very clear, I think, theory.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful contribution. So, as we're talking about the personal, what about Lou's personal life that you know that shaped some of his thinking? And some of the things that we talked a little bit about was, even in the last 10 years of his life, and especially after the death of his mother, he returned to reading Freud and Judaism. And so much of his life, just like we were talking about Harold Searles a few moments ago, and all of us, how our personal life comes in and makes up theory. Tell us about Lou and how his personal life was formative in his theoretical and practices.
So, you know, one of the things that I've done when I was thinking about how to write the introduction to this book, because as you can imagine, there are so many ways to write introductions. And my goal is to write something that will give something to people, you know, not just grieve his death or talk about how much I loved him or how much everybody appreciated him. But actually what I decided to do is to try and use the spirit of his teaching to do exactly what you're asking me now, to give people some understanding of who Lou was and how his personal life affected his own theory, which is exactly what he used to do for other people and when he taught. And I have many, many examples, but about for each chapter, actually, and the outline of the book about what is related to where. But I'll give you a few examples. I think one of the most meaningful things about Lou's history and childhood that he was very open about was that he was an only child. And he's one of those people, you know, that never felt bad about being an only child. And It was something we always talked about because he always said, like, when I was young, I was so happy. I never wanted to have siblings. I always thought, like, no, I want to be an only child. So it's so special. And never felt the loss of not having siblings. And I think he was very open about how that is related to his theory on mutuality. And how mutuality is not a very, it doesn't come to him so easily because he never had peers, right? And so he grew up and he used to say, you know, it's much, much easier for me to be a son or to be a father or to be a mentor and a teacher than to be a peer. And to be, I think part of our relationship was really, but that's why we processed that because we were peers, although Lou was almost 20 years older than me and much more advanced in the field when I started. But as time passed, we became more and more equal partners. And I think that was part of our dialogue about how, what is easier for him and what is harder and how he used to say that people write about the things that they are struggling with. He even used to say that people choose to practice schools, psychoanalytics, to join psychoanalytic schools that are difficult for him. He said, like, if you have a hard time with aggression, you might become a self-psychologist or a Kleinian, which is the other right, the other. And so that is one example of things that Lou used to talk about. And I'm thinking about if you mentioned the Judaism and Freud, and I'm thinking about that too, you know, which there was some similar dynamic with classical psychoanalysis and with Judaism, but that is related to, again, to the ways Lou thought about authority figures. So another thing that I don't know if people know about Lou, and again, he was very open about that and talked about it in interviews as well, about his personal life, is that he was, as an only child, he was very attached to his mother. He even called his parents in their first names, you know. He didn't call them mom and dad. He called them Git and Ruby. And throughout his life, Lou struggled to separate and differentiate from his mother. She was probably the most important, influential person in his life. And I believe that he reenacted that dynamic with the historical figures that he taught, which means, and tell me if that makes sense to you, you know, knowing him also and knowing his style, that what he have done is that when he taught somebody, he immersed himself in their life. He also identified with them, immersed himself in them, but then always rebelled against and differentiated himself from them. And this cycle was played out over and over again, identifying with his ancestors or with the theories he taught, followed by a wish to differentiate and break apart from them, and then reuniting with them. So we can easily recognize that cycle in his internal relationship with Freud's legacy, for example, which anyone who knew him, I mean, Lou was a Freudian. He admired Freud. He mastered Freud's theory, and he had a lot of reading groups on Freud. But then he rebelled against Freud and came back to him again and again. And you can see throughout his career how he started as a Freudian and then rebelled against it. And it's not, you know, it's an interesting thing that Lou always used to say, that the relational theory is both a revolution and an evolution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, another place that for me is as sort of a religious person, I was really struck with his return to his Jewish religion. And I have a students in my class, they say, if Roy asks you a question and you don't know the answer, just say boober and you'll get an A. And And I see it. I see that. And so in, and maybe it's one of my pulls to Lou even, but what I was wondering about, and part of telling story too, is about this return to his Judaism. I'm sure it's very complex, but he had to go away, as you just said, and then come back. And what occurred to me when I was reading, that Lou became convinced that the place of change within psychoanalysis was less about intellectual insight and more about what you guys even talk about in dramatic dialogues, the experience of a relationship in which there's a genuine responsiveness between two separate people as they interact upon the other. And here it seems to me that this idea that you talk about immersed, identified, rebelled, and then differentiated, is that he comes back to his religion because his psychoanalytic theory grew to where this idea of mutuality, and in the sense that he discovered what Buber did, and that it's in genuine meeting, we get a glimpse of the eternal thou. We get a glimpse of God in our most intimate encounters. So that's, I was playing with that idea and just want to.
I love that idea. I love it because that idea is really the idea about intimacy, right? And the way you think about relationship, right?
Yeah. And Buber, you know, again, too, his whole idea of meeting and mismeeting is very similar to what you just said about Lou, which is an immersion, a break, and a return.
That's so interesting.
And, you know, that's psychoanalysis if we really think about it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you know what? That is the moment, and as in many moments in my life, and is that I wish Lou was here to talk to you about it, because I have no doubt that he would have a lot to say about it. And that's a sad moment of thinking like, yeah, I'm sure that that's true for him, and he would have a whole dialogue, which is interesting because the dialogue, it would be also an intellectual dialogue, right? About what that means and how that, what these theories mean to him. But I'm thinking about what you're saying about the Judaism and the going back to his Jewishness. I mean, it's, if you think about it, the same cycle that I was describing before played out in Lou's relationship with Judaism as well. Because Lou was raised in a religious Jewish household, and being a Jewish was a very, very big part of his identity. While his family was religious, as Lou grew up and tried to separate from his mother, interestingly, he pushed himself to become more and more and more religious than his parents. And then, right, you would think that he would do the opposite, but no, he actually became more religious. He also moved to Jerusalem at some point when he was 19. He was always joking that he was there. I was born when he was 19. And so that was the time when he went to Jerusalem. His timing wasn't great. He couldn't find me yet. And also, he went to Jerusalem and I was in Tel Aviv. So the location was also not exactly right. But that was his joke, that he was there to look for me because it was just the year I was born, he was there. And so he became more and more Orthodox. And when he went to Jerusalem, he went to study in a yeshiva in Jerusalem. His mother, I would say, of course, followed him and turned more and more religious herself. Until, right? Because she followed him because she admired him, right? Which I think can also, as we know, as psychoanalysts, can also be a burden. Until at some point, Lou decided to rebel against religion and she became more religious and he became secular. So that was his relationship with Judaism, in my mind, is related to his relationship with his parents, especially with his mother. And he often mentioned that his psychoanalytic journey was very similar, if you think about his relationship with Freud, because as a student, he entered a Freudian analysis and he looked for more and at the most Freudian supervisors and tried to be even more orthodox than they were. But then he reached a point where he rebelled against classical theory and he joined his friend Stephen Mitchell in pushing against psychoanalytic orthodoxy, I would say. And so I think that you could see that his relationship with his religion, and I have to say that at the end of his life, in the last few years, not only, of course, after he got sick, but also I believe that it was related to the fact that his mother died, and his mother died, I would say, around 10 years before he died. And after her death, he became more religious and also more Freudian, I have to say. He went back to connected with his Judaism and also opened a few new reading groups on Freud and
that's right.
Studying the Torah.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
You know what I'm struck by right now, Galit, as we're talking too, is as we're talking about his personal life, it's like, well, was there a father?
It's so interesting, right? So think about the primal scene and about all of his writing. There is a, let me see which chapter that is. The internalized primal scene, and he talks about the Oedipal, really, really, really a topic that Lou was an expert in intellectually, that he would say that it was about the triangle of his father, mother, and him. I think his father was less dominant than his mother. And he would describe his father as a little bit more masochistic, as a little bit more less dominant than his mother.
Mm. Now, were you ever able to meet his parents?
No, but I went with him to visit his their grave a few times. And I said that my slip was his grave because actually he's buried next to them. So he had he's buried exactly where he wanted to, next to his parents. And when we started being together about a little bit more than 10 years ago, one of the first things Lou did is take me to visit his parents' grave.
I wonder if Stephen Mitchell became, because he loved Stephen Mitchell, right? And was very influenced in his rebellion against Freud, I guess. And if Stephen was a transitional object or something for him into mutuality. I don't know. I'm just playing here with ideas.
I don't know if a lot of people know that. First of all, Lou was very close to Steve.
Yeah.
And Steve died on Lou's birthday.
Oh, that's right.
December 21st, 2000.
Oh, my. Yeah.
And that was a very, very traumatic and painful thing. Obviously, his death was painful. But the story about that day that Lou told me many times is that Steve wrote Can Love Last? And he asked Lou to give him feedback. He sent him the manuscript and said, like, read it and write, you know, he wanted to edit it and get Lou's feedback on it. And Lou took a day off on his birthday, December 21st. And you know, anyone who knew Lou knew that for him, a day off, meaning he's going to read. That's his birthday gift to himself. And so he called Steve in the morning and he said to him, listen, I'm taking a day off and I'm going to get back to you at the end of the day with reading your book. And a few hours later, Steve died.
That's terribly sad. Yeah, yeah. Well, I would say he picked up a lot of the mantle of relational psychoanalysis post Stephen's death as well. And I think also now losing Lou early, there's a sadness to that for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There is a, you know, it does feel like the relational movement, if we can even call it a movement anymore, lost a lot of leaders in the, you know, and the last few years also. I mean, with Muriel death, with Philip Bromberg and mm-hmm. you, of course. And yeah. There was a lot of loss. And Jeremy Safran, which was a very close friend of Lou.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was a lot of loss.
Yeah. I'm curious if you could tell us how Lou has informed your own thinking, both as a theoretician and a clinician. So that's part A of my question. Part B is, and what do you think you taught Lou?
That's a very sweet question, which I think is related to the fact that Lou always learned from everyone, right?
Yeah.
And that was his thing. Listen, Lou was my partner and he was my best friend, and I shared with him everything I thought and my clinical work and, of course, everything I wrote. He read, which I miss very much. And I think one quality he had was to make people feel good about what they have to say. You know? And I think anyone who worked with Lou would say that. He never said like, oh, you need to do this, you need to do that, or you need to edit it. And his input was very tender and gentle. And usually he, like a good analyst, would listen to you and try to really help you develop your own ideas. And, you know, the main thing he gave me really is confidence in what I was doing, which is huge, right? I mean, what else do we need? If we're just saying like, you know, what I say is something that maybe has some value, or that I could be brave enough to publish, and of course it's very strange for me to write a new book without him reading everything. Again, Lou was not someone who would give you advice; he would encourage you to do exactly what he thought you know how to do, and that is feedback that I get from anyone who had worked with him. And I think that's why people really felt that he was, and he was very generous to people in what he gave them. You know, it was incredible to get his encouragement to just, do it. Just go for it, right?
The Nike commercial, just do it.
Yeah, I love it. Do it, you know?
I love that line that you said, he gave you confidence, and that it does go along with that line, just do it. And
you're great. You're like, I love it. You know, he would be so enthusiastic about things, which anyone needs that, right? That moment where you write something, especially the beginning of your career, and you have somebody like Lou who reads it and says like, wow, this is incredible. I love it.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It is. It's a lot. You know, I'm also thinking that must have had an influence on practice as well, about psychoanalysis. We can be so careful and so obscure. Mm-hmm. And there's something about his work that I feel and see that is get involved, co-create, get into it, do it.
Don't be afraid. You know, that's what he would say. Don't be afraid. Listen, Lou is a very, very brave guy. You know, we have done a lot of controversial things, and he was not afraid. He wasn't afraid of anyone. And I think, and that was what was part of what was so heartbreaking about the end of his life, because this man was a very, very brave man. And he was brave until the end. But he, you know, that was a real struggle with his health and with death that brought him to very complicated places emotionally, because he was used to being a man who is really not afraid.
Yeah. So, yeah. Did he die afraid, or was he, how would you say?
I don't know that he died afraid. He was always brave until the last minute. But I think at the end, he really asked himself, as I believe all of us will, when we know we're about to die, was he, you know, what does it mean? And we had a lot of conversations about death and about God, right? And was he good? And did he was he good to other people, and what was the last week of his life, I organized for him a Jewish prayer for his soul. I invited a few colleagues who are connected to Jewish religion, and we were sitting around his bed and praying for him. And that was a very special moment for all of us.
Yeah, I would think. Yeah. Bless you all on that, for sure. I want to ask you a couple of other questions about you and your future and that sort of thing. But I would like to just mention a couple things for our readers about this book. And there's two things that I think highlight him. And one on the chapter, "With You I'm Born Again." Lou, again, you get the complexity of his mind and his practice, because often there can be a misunderstanding of relational theory to be sort of a theory based only on the here and now, and two people just jabbering about the relationship. But in this chapter, you discover the depth of relational thinking in theory and in practice, because Lou takes us down this path of in utero development, primal fantasies, early object relations, unconscious fantasies, emergent properties, repetition compulsion. It's like, oh my goodness, this is so rich, right?
I know. You know, I think that for the people who will be, who read this book, what you will be surprised to learn, which I think that's what you're saying, and tell me if I'm right, is that Lou had incredible knowledge. And I don't think when I'm saying surprise, it's not surprising. Everybody knew that Lou had incredible knowledge. That was not a secret. But we think about him as a relationalist, right? As somebody who wrote about, the most famous things he wrote about, mutuality and about self-disclosure, about the analyst subjectivity, right? All of those back then very revolutionary relational ideas. But when you read the book, and I think that was part of what we were trying to do, is go back to the 80s. I think the first chapter I have here is really the chapters on dreams from 1989. And you would see that a lot of it is classical theory. It's exactly what you're saying, right? We're talking about Piaget. We have about a primal scene, about not only the analyst subjectivity, which of course is included, but the relational matrix, but a lot of themes about fantasy, unconscious fantasy, right? All of those things that seem, that you wouldn't think that Lou, that was his, that was his theory, but he actually, he knew everything about everything. And he was in his mind, he was, in his core, he was a classical theorist. First of all, before, and I think that's what I admired about him, that his development of relational psychoanalysis was based on knowing so much, right?
Yeah, and that's why I when I was reading that, I go, it's so easy to be sloppy in our work and in our theories, and I think when we don't keep grounding ourselves, why I have such admiration for him. He keeps grounding himself and his writings in what is at the bottom of all of this, and how do I build upon it? How am I playing with it and creating it? And it's a real lesson to all of us as practitioners and theorists and writers and what have you, to be really disciplined and because it creates such depth.
Yeah. I just want to add to it, because I like when you use the word discipline, because I do think that relational psychoanalysis is often blamed of not being disciplined enough, right? And analysts are blamed to, like, we like to interact. But I think that is actually not true. And definitely, you used the word discipline. I think that Lou was one of the people that had the most discipline I've ever known. And what he wrote was really, really is based on a lot of knowledge. And so that is a really important thing to add about really the discipline in creating new ideas based on a body of knowledge.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I want to just mention is that Lou is also, like, when I think back 26 years ago, he was a prophet in many ways. In his, on the chapter on internalized primal seeing published in 1995, he was either a prophet or just was so ahead of his time, because in that chapter, he repurposes heteronormative theories that opened up not only a greater understanding of the complexity of sexual identity, but paved the way for this whole complex understanding of the self as a web of multiplicity. That was huge. That was 26 years ago. And, you know, today we're all talking about it, but that wouldn't have been normal. It wouldn't be the case.
That's incredible, right?
It is really incredible. Yeah. Incredible.
And I think in the introduction of Steve Hartman to that chapter, you could see, and he actually follows it and talks about exactly that. I actually love the introductions to these, you know, to the chapters. I would like, if you don't mind, to just mention the people who wrote introductions. Except the first chapter was Lou's introduction, but then we have, I really chose people who worked very closely with him, not just, you know, he knew so many people and he had a lot of friends, and you can imagine it was really hard to choose who would write. So I, who would write and who would write what. I really tried to choose people who really had a relationship with him, a professional relationship with him, not a personal relationship with him, and worked with him on projects. So I have Adrian Harris there and Steve Hartman, who wrote about the primal scene, and the chapter on God influence on my psychoanalytic vision and values is the introduction is by Mike Eigen. There is the chapter, Tom Ogden, who Lou really appreciated and worked with many years ago, wrote a chapter. And Steve Kuchuk, of course, who was very close to Lou and worked with him, edited with him the psychoanalytic the book series, the psychoanalytic book series. And we have Hannah Ullman and Don Stern and Merav Roth. Of course, Jessica Benjamin and Joyce Lackauer and Jay Greenberg, which Lou highly, highly appreciated and worked with and always talked about. And so this introduction will give exactly that perspective that you're talking about, of really reading these articles years later. And what my request, I would say, was, is read this chapter and give us the readers something about the value of those articles in retrospect. And yeah. I think people did a really wonderful job.
They did. I'm not sure you mentioned Adrian Harris on Operational Thought, but...
Yes, she's the second chapter, Adrian Harris.
Yeah. And to listeners, his good friend, Stephen Kuchuk, I will be interviewing him in June. Of his new book. So yeah.
That's wonderful, cool. Wonderful new book.
Yes, it is.
Dedicated to Lou. And I really highly recommend Steve Kuchuk's book.
So Galit, tell us what you're up to today. And I know you have a new book coming out. And when will it be on the shelves? And what is the book about?
Hey, so I do have a new book that I finished writing and just finished editing and actually just chose the cover. And this is my first book that is not going to be published by Routledge, but going to be published by a trade publisher. And it's a book for the public that tries to introduce psychoanalytic ideas to a general audience. The book is called Emotional Inheritance. And it introduces, I would say, the many faces of inherited trauma, what we call intergenerational transmission of trauma. But not only trauma, every inherited emotional inheritance and the ways we carry our parents and grandparents. And I talk there, I have a whole section on grandparents and a section on parents, unprocessed experiences, especially trauma, but not only trauma. It's not only for clinicians, and it tells my own stories as well as my patients, and it definitely introduces to the public psychoanalytic thinking on, on the unconscious, on a lot, some theory, and on our emotional inheritance.
Lovely. And when do you think it'll be out, did you say?
So the book will be published by Little Brown, and it will be out, I think it's January 25th.
Okay, good.
So we still have a little pregnancy to go, probably 7 months, I think, from now.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to reading it, for sure. Yeah.
Thank you. And the book is dedicated to the memory of Lou.
Yeah.
And some of the chapters he have read when I started writing it about maybe 2.5 years ago when he was really sick, and he read some of it. But some of the chapters he's mentioned in them, when there is one chapter on loss and working with a patient who loses a very dear person while I'm going through that, and I introduce those thoughts of how do we hold and contain another person's loss when we struggle with our own.
Yeah. Well, Galit, this has been wonderful for me. I'm wondering to be with you this afternoon and talk about this book and to sort of have this almost somewhat intimate conversation about a man we both highly admire and with whom you loved and had a life partnership with. It's been very wonderful for me. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything else you want to add before we call it a day, or?
I just want to add a thank you to you. This is very special. And this is, a very special project for me. So I am very happy to be here today and talk to you about it. Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you so much.